Since the fall of Assad, the Israeli military has been bombing Syria, and Israel's prime minister says he'll double the size of settlements in the Golan Heights.
In many ways, he's flexing his muscle.
I'm Marco Werman. We'll hear more about the volatile Golan along the Israeli-Syrian border. Also, Western sanctions on Russian oil are part of the reason why dodgy tanker ships are a real risk for oil spills at sea.
It's a problem that we've helped create for ourselves, and the irony is not lost on many, I don't think.
Plus, the European Union plans to build its own satellite-based internet service to compete with Elon Musk's Starlink system, and how to live a really long life.
The Mediterranean climate, combined with the Mediterranean diet and the lifestyle.
All true, but the secret to longevity is still a mystery. That and more coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us this Monday. We begin in the Golan Heights, the rocky mountainous region near the borders of Israel, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. Israel claims the Golan Heights as its territory. The international community, with the exception of the U.S., disagrees. Over the weekend, Israel's government approved a plan to double the Israeli population in the Golan Heights. The Israeli military has also sent troops from the Golan Heights across the border and into Syrian territory. All of this in the days after the Assad regime fell in Syria. Joshua Landis is with the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I asked him why Israel is taking these actions now.
They're doing it because Syria is extraordinarily weak, and this is a real moment of opportunity for Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu is, in a sense, a conquering hero in Israel. He's rebuilt his popularity. He's destroyed Hezbollah largely and cut off arms supply that used to go through Syria from Iran to Hezbollah. He's flipped the country from being part of the axis of resistance to being a Sunni-dominated state that's allied with Turkey. So in many ways, he's flexing his muscle. And this is a moment when the government in Damascus is in chaos, is trying to consolidate its power. The new army has not taken control of the military sites and is not prepared to resist Israel's expansion to the rest of the Golan Heights and to take Mount Hermon. Israel can do it with very little pushback.
Mount Hermon is a strategically important mountain. I've heard about the Golan Heights my entire life, Joshua. Who actually lives there?
Well, there are 21,000 Syrians, largely Druze Syrians from this religious minority, and there are 30,000 Israeli settlers. Before 1967, in the Israeli occupation, there were over 100,000 Syrians living there. They were expelled, and the villages, Arab villages, over 100, were destroyed. And then the Israeli settlers began to move into the region.
What makes the Golan Heights strategically important?
It's a high, elevated plateau that separates Israel from Syria. And whoever holds it has a strategic advantage. It's also much of the headwaters to Lake Tiberias and the rivers, the Jordan River, come from the Golan Heights. And it's good agricultural land, a lot of vineyards, and it's a beautiful place.
So take us back to 1967. Remind us of how Israel came to control the Golan in the first place.
The British and the French negotiated this division in 1923, roughly, and it was been disputed ever since. And in the 48 war, when Israel got its independence and Syria sided with the Palestinians, both armies clashed over that border. And there was a demilitarized zone. In 67, they had been fighting just prior to the 1967 war. Both Israel and Syria had been fighting over this demilitarized zone. And Israel wanted the demilitarized zone for its own farmers and in order to bring water from the Jordan River to Israel. And so there was shooting from Syrian side, and Israel returned fire. And this turned into the 67 war when most of the Golan Heights was occupied by Israel.
So another piece of territory that's been disputed for pretty much a century, now under Israeli control. And now Israel says it's going to expand its settlements in the Golan Heights. What would that look like?
Well, there are about 30,000 settlers, and to expand them, to double them, as Prime Minister Netanyahu has said he will do, would mean to increase them by 60%. And this is an effort to establish permanent Israeli control over this region. Interestingly, in 1973, after the 73 war, President Nixon was hoping for a comprehensive peace. He criticized President Johnson after the Six-Day War for allowing Israel to keep control of the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai Peninsula. He thought this land for peace deal had complicated things for America in the Middle East because Israel very quickly got used to owning that land and moving settlers onto it. And he wanted to reverse that after the 73 war. But he failed, as we know, because of Watergate and many other reasons. But that has been an ongoing thorn in America's side, is this is trying to adjudicate these disputes, which have caused much of the Arab world to have prolonged disputes with the United States.
Finally, Joshua, Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan, are condemning Israel for moving troops into what it's calling a buffer zone inside Syrian territory. Israel says those troops are there temporarily. What is going on there, and what is the risk of things spiraling out of control?
You know, Israel is stating that it's land for peace, that it's temporary, and that it's ensuring its borders. But that was the same thing that it did in 1967 when it took the West Bank and the Golan Heights and Gaza Strip. And, you know, very quickly, one gets used to owning those territories. And whether Israel will withdraw from them is a big question.
Joshua Landis heads up the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. It is the largest iceberg on planet Earth, about the size of metropolitan London, and for decades it was stationary. But more recently, A23A, as the iceberg is known, was actually spinning in place due to an ocean vortex. It's now free, and the giant iceberg is on the move. Till Wagner is an oceanographer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
It's one of the most imposing natural phenomena out there. So it's about, we think, about 400 meters thick and 1,500 square miles. I actually measured it today on satellite pictures. It's about 1,400 square miles now. So something like 30 by 40 miles in each direction. It's roughly square. So you can think of it as a giant, very thin piece of ice, relatively speaking, right? It's 400 meters thick, but it is rather thin in some respects.
Yeah, so 400 meters, I mean, that's like a quarter mile thick. How much of that is above the water? What are you seeing?
Yeah, the tip of the iceberg, right?
Right,
so
exactly.
It's about one-tenth of it will be visible. So you probably have a freeboard. The freeboard is the part above the waterline. That's about 40 meters, I would estimate, something like that. So if you're on a ship next to it, it'll be an imposing cliff rising above you.
Explain how A23A got stuck and what made it spin in place.
Yeah, there's a seamount just north of the South Orkney Islands. And theory has it that, so if you have a mountain underneath the ocean, that the ocean currents are steered topographically around this seamount, and that the iceberg was just trapped in this steering vortex that goes around and around this seamount. What we do know was that it was stuck in that location for about the last 6 to 7 months, and just a couple of weeks ago, sometime in late November, it broke off, and now it's drifting at fairly good pace north.
And we're talking the southern Atlantic Ocean?
We're talking the southern Atlantic Ocean, exactly. And so at its current trajectory, it's moving towards South Georgia, although it's moving maybe slightly to the east of South Georgia. And I looked at it today, it's about 10 miles per day that it is moving.
So how did it actually finally break free and start moving again, this iceberg, A23A?
Yeah, so the idea is that it was this stationary vortex around the seamount. There's a lot more variability and eddies and different ocean circulation going on around there. So my guess is that it just sort of got caught in a slightly different current and that extracted it from there.
I mean, the story of how A23A got stuck and how it got free, does it provide us with any useful information about the movement of other icebergs across the oceans?
It is interesting because everyone was kind of expecting it to, you know, keep drifting and maybe do a couple of rotations, but not be stuck in the same place for 6 months. So I think as we're going forward, and especially putting icebergs into climate models, it'll be important to take this type of motion into consideration.
It does seem that all icebergs eventually melt and crumble, even ones this size. What impact does that have on the ocean ecosystem when an iceberg this size falls apart?
So this is a great question. And the icebergs are made of frozen freshwater. And as they melt into the seawater, they totally change the oceanography around it and provide important nutrients and other oceanographic changes that often help super boosting the ecosystem in the environment.
Heading north, as you said, and at a pretty good clip, I'm assuming any ships in the vicinity of A23A, based on your description, will see it because of its size. But is that a given?
Yeah, you're not going to miss this. I mean, this is the size. The size, as you said, like, it's bigger than Greater London.
Till Wagner is a professor in the Department of Atmosphere and Ocean Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He was explaining what's happened with the giant A23A iceberg in the South Atlantic. We learned yesterday of the death of the legendary Indian percussionist Zakir Hussain, a man who, by any objective measure, was able to speak with his fingers. Over the years on this program, I've had the privilege of speaking with Zakir Hussain a few times. He was born in India to a family where the tabla was revered. His father was also a percussion master, and Zakir demonstrated his talent at an early age. He left India, though, and landed in the San Francisco Bay Area just when Eastern philosophy was becoming a thing and where his reputation preceded him. 3 years ago, Zakir Hussain told me that he was greeted in America with an odd kind of respect he never encountered in India. It was at a 1970 concert in New York at the Fillmore East with sitar virtuoso Ravi Shankar.
I sat down on the stage, and it was dark in the hall, and there was an incredible smell. And I said, what is this smell? And then I finally realized that the whole audience, each one of them, was holding a burning incense in their hand. So just imagine 1,000 incenses, what kind of a smell that would have.
Wow. and that presumably never happens in India.
Oh, it never happens in India. And in India, you can see the audience. Here, you couldn't see the audience. And in India, in those days, you could have an interaction with the audience. Somebody would shout out, yeah, that's great, do that again, and stuff like that. But there was not that kind of an interaction.
Zakir Hussain and his mastery of the tabla were immediately in demand. He played with George Harrison, became friends with Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead, and became part of Hart's revolutionary percussion group, Planet Drum. In 1973, he formed the fusion ensemble Shakti with jazz guitarist John McLaughlin. And about 10 years ago, Zakir Hussain took on another intriguing collaboration, weaving the tabla into American roots music alongside banjo player Bela Fleck and bassist Edgar Meyer. At the time, Zakir reflected on his career success outside India.
Well, I have to say I've been very lucky. It probably has been the case of being in the right place and just running into these people and finding out that there was a connection that was already established way in the past that we didn't know about. And I'm really fortunate that I happened to be in this part of the world at the time when there was this incredible awakening or towards the Eastern way of looking at music. And I just happened to be here. And John and people like Mickey Hart and then Bela and Edgar and all just kind of found me. And I'm lucky that I was foundable.
The late Indian tabla master Zakir Hussain speaking with me 3 years ago. He died yesterday in San Francisco. Zakirji, as the master was known, was 73.
Hi, I'm Matthew Bell, an editor and reporter for The World. I work closely with our hosts and correspondents based around the globe to bring you stories that matter. Recently, I reported on the surprise move by South Korea's president, Yoon Suk-yeol, to declare martial law and suspend the legislature in Seoul. This was one of those day of breaking news stories that required some real hustle from us here in the Boston newsroom. But this story is not over, and I'm currently planning a trip to South Korea to do more in-depth reporting about what's at stake in this political moment for the people of that country. This sort of journalism takes time and effort and, of course, money. At The World, we're committed to delivering nuanced journalism that puts real people at the center of every story. But as an independent, nonprofit newsroom, we can't do it without you. Your support, especially recurring gifts, makes our journalism possible. It gives us the time to ask tough questions, tackle hard issues, and plan future coverage that keeps you informed and engaged. Right now, your gift can have double the impact. If you value journalism that dives deeper, shines a light on critical global issues, and gives you context you can trust, please donate before December 31st. Visit theworld.org/give to make your gift today. That's theworld.org/give. And thanks so much.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In South Korea, the six justices on the country's constitutional court began an important task today, decide whether or not to remove the South Korean president from office. Yoon Suk-yeol was impeached over the weekend. It was the second time lawmakers voted on impeachment since Yoon sent the country into political turmoil a little over a week ago by declaring martial law. Saturday's motion passed when a handful of the president's own party members voted yes. Opposition party leader Lee Jae-myung said what's needed now is a full investigation into the president's actions. Lee said to hold accountable those responsible for this absurd situation, the authorities need to act quickly to uncover the truth. The whole nation is watching, he added. Justices on the Constitutional Court have up to 6 months to decide whether to remove President Yoon or reinstate him. Yoon has vowed to fight to the end, but he's lost some key allies. Earlier today, the head of the president's People Power Party resigned. Han Dong-hoon had said he would help the president find a graceful way to step down. But when Yoon refused, Han did a 180 and supported Yoon's impeachment. If the court does decide to remove President Yoon, a new presidential election will be held in 60 days. Over the weekend, a Russian oil tanker went down in the Black Sea. Video shot from on board the ship appears to show the vessel split in two as oil leaks out, eventually spilling more than 4,000 tons of oil into the water. Many countries worry about just this kind of thing happening in their own waters, especially with the movement of Russia's shadow fleet, ships with murky ownership and dicey insurance that transport Russia's sanctioned crude oil to market. The World's Joshua Koh reports from Denmark.
It's the middle of November, and I'm heading to Nyborg Beach with Christina C. The sky is gray, and there's a dusting of snow on the ground. In short, it's not a beach day.
That's a Maersk vessel going through. You can even see the different containers on top.
C is a university professor and one of Denmark's leading experts on maritime law. She's taking me to one of the most important sea lanes in the world. It's a strait called the Great Belt. The ship in front of us heads out from under a huge bridge to our right. Called the Great Belt Bridge, it rises up over the strait between two of Denmark's biggest islands. As C puts it, the bridge drastically narrows the options for ships traveling through an already narrow channel.
It's been designed so that the big vessels can go under it, but they can only go under it at that specific point. As you can see, there's a low bridge over here. And then there is a high bridge in the middle where the vessels can get under it.
So this is a true bottleneck.
This is a bottleneck.
Authorities say Danish waters are some of the most congested in the world and characterized by narrow passages and shallow water. The high volume of international sea traffic through these waters is possible thanks to a treaty called the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS.
UNCLOS basically allows vessels innocent passage even through other people's territorial waters.
But there's a growing number of ships passing through these waters that are anything but innocent. Collectively, these ships are known as the Russian Shadow Fleet. Most of them tend to be over 17 years old. Now they carry sanctioned Russian crude oil out of the Baltic, and Denmark is not happy about it. That's according to Niels Vong, the former head of the Danish Navy.
The big risk of accident here is basically pollution.
Fong says that in part because of their age, these ships could be more prone to accidents, but also because of how they're operated by the crew. They conduct risky ship-to-ship oil transfers in a hurry, and to avoid detection, the crews switch off important tracking systems. They even refuse assistance from local pilots.
I mean, if they are full of oil and they collide with another ship because they are drunk or not awake, or if they run aground for the same reasons, then you have a huge problem.
These concerns over the environmental risks of the Shadow Fleet seem to be common among Western countries and many analysts. But some, like Sergei Vakalenko, say the risks are way overstated. He says that despite what happened over the weekend in the Black Sea, the risks of a Shadow Fleet ship causing an oil spill are low.
Usually the discussion on how dangerous the Shadow Fleet tankers are is based on anecdotal evidence, and that's where I have a problem with it.
Vakalenko is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's based in Berlin. He previously worked for Gazprom Neft, one of Russia's largest oil producers. And as he sees it, all this hubbub about the Shadow Fleet causing an environmental catastrophe is nothing more than a pretext for enforcing Western sanctions.
So it was a valiant and rather elegant idea. It might be worth to try it to make it work, but then it has its limits.
Sanctions have dented Russia's oil revenues, for example. But Moscow has earned almost $600 billion since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. That's in large part because Western countries need that oil, even as they sanction it.
This is basically oil that is funding, essentially, genocide.
Vaibhav Raghunandan is an analyst based in Amsterdam for the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air.
This is oil that is going to circumvent sanctions. And this is oil that is going into third countries who will refine this and then give you the refined product, which you are benefiting out of despite trying to look the other way.
Basically, sanctions prohibit Western countries from importing Russian crude oil by sea. But there's nothing to prevent countries like India, Turkey, or China from buying it, refining it, and then selling it back to European countries. And as a result, three Shadow Fleet tankers pass through Danish waters every day, heading to and from Russia.
It's a problem that we've helped create for ourselves, and the irony is not lost on many, I don't think.
Maritime law expert Christina C., who's been advising the Danish government on its legal response to the Shadow Fleet, says the country is exploring options to sort out this problem. Remember UNCLOS, that international treaty that lets Shadow Fleet ships pass through the Danish Straits? While UNCLOS prevents coastal countries from stopping ships, it does allow them to take actions to protect their environment. C says that that might mean that Danish officials could board ships to demand a look at their insurance.
If we were to find out that a vessel is not insured, we haven't tried that yet. It would be new practice, but I believe that UNCLOS allows for us in that case to see, it seems that you have no insurance, you'll have to lie still until you get one, and if you don't get one, then we will board you and we will tow you to shore, for example.
In the world of insurance for oil tankers, Western companies have a near monopoly. So Shadow Fleet tankers are forced to find more dubious sources. And that makes a ship's insurance a potential way to identify a vessel as part of the Russian Shadow Fleet, says analyst Vaibhav Raghunandan.
You make sure that these vessels that are badly insured are put on sanctions lists. That means that countries will refuse to accept any cargo being delivered by these ships.
Analysts agree that sanctioning the individual ships is currently one of the most effective ways to tighten the screws on the Shadow Fleet. Right now, 79 ships are no longer welcome in European ports, for example, including some three dozen that were added to the list last week. While it may seem like more of a game of whack-a-mole, Raghunandan says there may be early indications that it's helped deter countries like India from buying Russian crude oil. He proposes sanctioning some of the refineries in these countries. But in the short term, there has to be some kind of balance between sanctions and ensuring that some oil still gets to Western ports. For The World, I'm Joshua Koh.
People from all over Thailand travel to one small coastal town to enjoy this bright orange curry soup.
It's so, so good.
And the secret ingredient that makes it so special?
My love it.
They don't explode when you bite down. They're chewy. You'll see.
Spicy and chewy. That's coming up in this half hour on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Elon Musk's Starlink satellite system provides wireless internet, no internet cables needed, basically anywhere in the world. It's been essential to the war effort in Ukraine, for example. Now the European Union is looking to build its own satellite-based system for internet access. The project is called IRIS², and it might not be born out of competition so much as out of necessity. Peggy Hollinger is a space editor for the Financial Times.
IRIS² is the culmination of several years kind of reflection, work, and negotiation. Europe has come to realize that it needs and wants sovereign communication capability in the newest area of space really to be developed, which is low Earth orbit. And they've seen the role that Starlink played in Ukraine with the volatile geopolitical situation. They see IRIS² as providing that sovereign access in times of crisis or emergency.
And the EU does not see Starlink as having that kind of sovereign character to it. Is that right?
Well, it's not. It wouldn't be sovereign, would it, if it were Elon Musk? Elon Musk is an American citizen. He's the owner of a private company, and he runs that company, yes, very competitively, very aggressively. He's been very successful. He's got more than 6,000 satellites up there. It's very hard for anyone to compete. But also, his loyalties are to his company and to himself, rather than a sovereign system whose mission is to provide that sovereign capability to European member states. So while some people will put this up as, you know, a competitor to Elon Musk, I don't think that's the main mission of this system. The system is to ensure that Europe is not caught short, but also a huge motivation is also to give a pipeline of work to Europe's space ecosystem. And it's very clear that in the United States, billions of dollars can be put in the way of U.S. companies to help them develop. That's how Elon Musk developed SpaceX, with very large contracts from NASA and latterly from the Department of Defense. So Europe, as a combination of, you know, 27 member states, actually, this is one way to pool together their need for sovereign capability and to give a pipeline of work, development work, to the European space ecosystem, which, let's face it, has been struggling.
So what are the security and political issues with the EU using Starlink?
No one wants to be strategically reliant on any one entity, especially if it's a foreign entity. So I can go back into history and I can tell you that, you know, one of the reasons why Europe is so keen to have its own launch capability is because, you know, decades ago when they relied on NASA to launch, NASA actually withdrew authorization for a launch of a commercial satellite. And, you know, that memory still lasts in Europe. What we have realized in this very volatile world where conflicts appear and nation states are realizing that they can't rely on the United States to defend them anymore. Trump has made it very clear that he expects others to step up to the plate. And so they need to spend more money on developing their sovereign capabilities, whether it be in defense, whether it be in communications. Remember, the motive is dual. One, to provide the secure communications at a time of crisis. And two, also to give that pipeline of work to the space industry.
I was just going to say, it seems like a significant advance for Europe's space industry, but how much is it going to cost? And is there any consensus for how the EU is going to pay for it?
Yes, it's already been decided how it will be paid for. It's 10.5 billion euros will come from both the European Commission and that will have been agreed by the member states and from the European Space Agency, and the rest will be funded by the industrial consortium. If the costs overrun, I think that will be a big issue. Depending on how the work is awarded, you can see potential conflict amongst member states in future. Right now in Europe, there's a lot of tension between France and Germany over the space industry and over collaboration in space. In Germany, they sort of fear that France wants to take all the work for itself. France has traditionally been Europe's sort of cradle of expertise for space technology and space industry. But Germany also has ambitions and some very good companies. And there is a big question mark about how much work goes to Germany, how much work goes to France, how much goes to Spain and Italy. But they are trying to resolve that by replicating some of what has been done in the United States, which is, you know, you don't buy the kit anymore, you buy the service. So basically what Europe is trying to do here is trying to change, you know, the habit of decades. And instead of actually allocating contracts to each nation state on the basis of how much that nation state invests in the program, they are trying to do it in reverse, say, who are the most competitive suppliers? They're the ones we're going to choose, and then get backing from the government for the investment in the program. So it is a test case of many different things. It's a test case of Europe's ability to manage and develop a program like this on this scale in a more competitive way. It's a test case for collaboration in Europe, in space, and it's a test case for European industry to see whether they can actually come up with something competitive.
Peggy Hollinger is a space editor for the Financial Times. 3 years ago, Amazon opened a warehouse in a poor neighborhood of Tijuana, the Mexican border city not far from San Diego. Residents hoped that the arrival of one of the richest companies on Earth would make a real difference for their humble community. But as KPBS reporter Gustavo Solis reports, those expectations remain largely unfulfilled.
The photos were jarring. A shiny new Amazon warehouse right in the middle of a Tijuana shantytown. The images went viral and sparked a heated debate about global inequality. The local business community in Tijuana praised the new September 2021 edition, calling it a welcome boost to the economy. And Amazon at the time issued a statement saying the company feels, quote, great responsibility toward communities where we operate, end quote. Now, the company wasn't specific about what it meant by great responsibility, yet residents of the neighborhood, known as Nueva Esperanza, hoped that Amazon would make investments to improve their quality of life. But 3 years later, they say that little has changed.
No hay luz regular, no hay agua, no hay drenajes.
Marley Trinidad Mejilla lives in Nueva Esperanza. She says the community still lacks paved roads, drinkable water, and a functional storm drain system. Mejilla is among many who came to the community in recent decades looking for a new start. Mejilla earns 2,000 pesos a week as a janitor, working for a factory in the same business park as the Amazon Fulfillment Center. That comes out to about $100 a week, almost twice as much as what she used to earn in Chiapas, Mexico's southernmost state. She knows that her corporate neighbors earn billions of dollars a year and thinks that they should reinvest more of that money into the neighborhood. The juxtaposition of one of the richest companies in the world setting up shop amid such poverty was also striking to Teddy Cruz. He's the director of urban research at UC San Diego's Center on Global Justice.
That photo of the Amazon, you know, big warehouse next to this very precarious informal settlement was very dramatic. And really,
Amazon is hardly the first corporate superpower to establish operations in Mexico. Tijuana is home to hundreds of light industrial facilities called maquiladoras that have opened since 1994. That's when Congress ratified the North American Free Trade Agreement, known as NAFTA. But Cruz says that the viral photo kickstarted an important conversation about corporate responsibility.
By that I mean as these epicenters of wealth that generate so much revenue and so much profit, can there be some level of co-responsibility to invest in the communities ultimately from which they are getting their own labor?
In Nueva Esperanza, the neighborhood's only school also serves as a local community hub. Maria Patricia Chavez is the director. The school opened 5 years ago with just 10 students. The first classrooms were built from plywood, 2x4s, and other scraps donated by neighborhood parents. In one building, a garage door serves as the dividing wall between two classrooms.
Entonces, pues poco a poco, varios padres, pues ellos se fueron uniendo la colonia a hacer donaciones que un barrote, yo tengo otro pedazo de tripla, y entonces pues así.
Today, the school has more than 200 students. And thanks to funding from a nonprofit and the Baja California state government, they also have a new classroom and a bathroom. Chavez says that this is the only indoor plumbing some of the students have regular access to. The school has also received some corporate support.
Ellos vienen y trabajan, pero directamente con los niños. Ellos hicieron donación de ciertos libros para armar una biblioteca.
Amazon, for example, donated books for the library, and they send people to run reading workshops for the students. In a statement, Amazon Mexico said, quote, "We understand the importance of serving the communities in which our employees live and work. It's why we've partnered with numerous local organizations in Tijuana to support important causes like literacy and health and food insecurity for residents in Nueva Esperanza," end quote. The company says it's also invested more than $50 million in Baja California. Now, even though locals believe that their corporate neighbors could do more to help the neighborhood, they say that the bulk of the responsibility falls on Tijuana's government. Blanca Veneza Sosa has lived in the community for years. She says lack of government investment is particularly noticeable whenever it rains. The combination of unpaved roads and the lack of drainage create a river of mud through the entire neighborhood. She says everything shuts down during storms. Tijuana's former mayor, Monserrat Caballero, declined an interview request. Tijuana's new mayor, Ismael Burgueño, could not be reached for comment. For The World, I'm Gustavo Solís, Tijuana.
Legislation that would remove the British monarchy from Jamaica could be brought forward as soon as tomorrow. The bill has 36 clauses in all and is meant to put the Jamaican constitution into proper form, so says the Minister of Legal and Constitutional Affairs. Key among those provisions is to abolish the constitutional monarchy. Instead of the King of England, Jamaica's formal head of state would be a president, making the Caribbean nation officially a republic. But the constitutional process is complicated, and the Minister of Legal Affairs acknowledges that the bill may not have enough support to pass. The ruling party in Jamaica's parliament says the constitutional reforms will happen in phases. Removal of King Charles, the party says, is the first phase. The opposition party, however, says other provisions can and should be prioritized. If you spent any time looking into human longevity, you might have heard of blue zones. These few spots around the world are where people allegedly live a lot longer than the global average. Researchers are still trying to figure out why this might be. In the meantime, another cluster of long lifers has been found in a place no one ever thought to look. It's in one specific neighborhood in the city of Barcelona. It's called L'Eixample. The World's Jerry Haddon reports.
L'Eixample is known more as a smog zone than a blue zone. Air pollution on its gridded streets far exceeds limits set by the World Health Organization. As for green spaces, it's mostly the potted plants on people's balconies. This is hardly the environment for an extra long life. And yet...
Lolita Oliver Claros.
I'm 93 years old, says this woman named Lolita Oliver Claros. I'm nearly 94. Oliver Claros is sitting in her wheelchair by an open produce market in the heart of L'Eixample. At her age, she's helping boost the average lifespan of women in this neighborhood. Right now, it stands at 87.5 years. Globally, it's at 76 years. More than 200 women here have reached the big 100. Oliver Claros could well join their ranks. I no longer have my husband, she says, but my caretaker and I come out each day to do some food shopping, depending on what I feel like eating. Although some days we don't buy anything, she says, I don't have much appetite. Oliver Claros' caretaker is Manana, a woman from the country of Georgia. The two will sit out here for most of the morning, watching the loud, steady traffic, the beeping delivery trucks, the crowds of tourists checking into their Airbnbs. It's all concrete and chaos. And according to the latest longevity research, not a place to reach the ripest of old ages.
What is the secret to living a long time?
Community.
Perhaps it's the food.
Just by walking.
Spending time in nature.
Tons of studies and documentaries are out there trying to explain why some people tend to live so much longer than everybody else. For researcher Vaslav Jan Kruček, it's location, 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 mostly.
The Mediterranean climate, combined with the Mediterranean diet and the lifestyle, is very advantageous for longevity. I think that few know that all people who were 116 or more in Europe, all of them lived in the Mediterranean with one sole exception.
That was a woman in Poland, where Kruček does his research. He's with the Gerontology Research Group, a global group of researchers who interview the elderly and verify their ages, sometimes for Guinness World Records. Besides where you live, he says, it's who's around you.
The supercentenarians are usually, traditionally, people who are characterized with very tight familial bonds. They stick together, they are socially engaged. We humans, we are social entities. Our mental health is very much linked to the other people with which we live.
Gente de barrio.
We are Plaza people, says 83-year-old Maria Dolores Pereira, sitting on a bench with her husband Alfredo, who's 88. Here in Les Champlas, she says, we all have family, siblings. We've been here for 100 years.
Barcelona has lots of neighborhoods, yet none with so many long-lived residents, according to the city's annual census of registered residents. Why? Well, in part because there are simply lots of people here. L'Eixample is Barcelona's densest neighborhood, and Barcelona is one of the densest cities in Europe. As for the pollution and the crowds,
I think it's because today's elderly grew up in a different era, says a local fruit seller who would only give her first name Yolanda. My grandmother had seven siblings, and they all lived long lives. Before, she says, the air wasn't so dirty. It was a different time. Yolanda says that when she retires, she'll leave L'Eixample for a cleaner community. But 93-year-old resident Lolita Olive Claro says she's not going anywhere. I have lived here since 1957, she says. This was all open fields. Then they built the houses. When it comes to longevity, there are so many factors at play. Complicating things, says researcher Krucik, is that a lot of our longevity is baked in at birth, the old lucky roll of the DNA. Still, he cautions people not to rest on their chromosomes. Imagine, he says,
we have the genes, but we smoke, we drink alcohol, we overeat. And with the genes or not, we will likely not achieve a high age. It is equally important to keep good lifestyle, because we can live 90 healthy years.
A long health span within our lifespan, he says. That's what we should all be shooting for. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Apocalyptic, chaos, total disaster. That's how survivors are describing the aftermath of Cyclone Chido in a place called Mayotte. It's a French territory in the Indian Ocean made up of two islands that are much closer to Africa than they are to Europe. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports on the extent of the devastation.
The footage from the island is shocking. A third of the homes destroyed, entire neighborhoods gone, just flattened. The local prefect says hundreds of people are likely dead, and the death toll may run into the thousands. François-Xavier Bioville spoke to the local TV station Mayotte La Première on Sunday night.
Cet événement a été extrêmement dur pour chacun d'entre nous.
He says, this disaster has been very hard for every one of us. We're doing everything we can to restore services. I'm thinking of each and every one of you. He says getting an official death count will be hard since many of the island's residents are undocumented. France's Interior Ministry estimates that 100,000 migrants were squatting in shanty towns on the island. The majority of them are from even poorer countries like the Comoros and Somalia. And on Mayotte, they live in shaky tin homes that were no match for the 140-mile-per-hour winds.
Avec le cyclone qui est arrivé, toutes les maisons étaient rasées.
This man spoke to local TV crews. He stood in the middle of what was once his kitchen. He says, when the cyclone came, the whole house was razed. I lost everything. Everything's gone. On X, Mayotte's representative in France's National Assembly wrote that when the buildings caved in, residents were engulfed by mud and sheet metal. Most of the houses were stripped of their roofs, she said, and there was no electricity, water, or food. This was confirmed by Senator Salam Al-Ramia, who told BFM TV that the shelters don't have the necessary supplies and people are starting to go hungry. It's urgent that aid arrives, she says, especially when you see the children and babies at the shelters. We have nothing to give them. Even before this happened, the French government has been accused of underinvesting in Mayotte. Around three-quarters of the population lives in poverty. And a government report earlier this year highlighted problems with disaster management in the area. French President Emmanuel Macron said his thoughts were with the people of Mayotte, and he has pledged aid for the island. France is sending troops and supplies, with more help expected to arrive in the coming days. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
There's a region in the south of Thailand where pretty much everything is turned up a notch. The dialect is faster, the sun feels hotter, and the food isn't just spicy, it is atomic. So to wrap things up today, the world's Patrick Nguyen takes us to a curry joint in southern Thailand where he went behind the scenes to find out the secret to an insanely popular soup.
The chef at this backstreet curry spot is in the zone. Jay Mao is 55, hair in a bun, Buddhist amulet around her neck. She's the queen of this cinder block kitchen, and she holds in her fist a frightening number of red chilies. I ask, how many is that? She says, let's say 20. Around here, Jay Mao says, we eat mega spicy. Central Thai food, served in most Thai restaurants around the world, she says it's a bit bland. We're in a seaside town called Pranburi, and Jay Mao is making gang som, the region's signature dish. It means orange curry. Jay Mao dumps the chilies into a blender. She adds garlic, a whole onion, and a gob of fermented shrimp paste, thick as mud. I'm adding tamarind juice, she says. Fish sauce, a squeeze of lime. Now it's time to dump it all in a metal pot, on a gas stove, over a roaring blue-hot flame. The smell in the kitchen is overpowering, as it should be. She says, smells good, huh? Gets up in your nose. Jay Mao opened this restaurant more than 20 years ago. Open-air kitchen in back, a few wooden tables in front, just a block or two from the sea. It's a modest place, yet it draws celebrities from Bangkok. They eat next to local fishermen. Jay Mao didn't get her rep making regular old curries. She adds a special ingredient, kept in a cooler. Fish eggs, from what's called the giant marine catfish, Bla Ryu Kyu in Thai. It's native to brackish waters in Thailand, Myanmar, and Vietnam. Its eggs are big as marbles, but do they pop in your mouth like caviar? No, she says. They don't explode when you bite down. They're chewy. You'll see. The orange curry is done cooking, and as the name implies, it is the color of a parking cone. Jay Mao pours it all into a ceramic bowl. Only at the end does she plop in the fish eggs, translucent light green, the size and color of grapes. Okay, time to eat. I've brought my wife, Pai Lin, to evaluate. Her family is from southern Thailand.
It's so, so good. The roe is camembert soft.
Camembert. These fish eggs taste like cheese?
Yeah, kinda. Yeah, tastes like a soft cheese with a harder cover, like camembert.
Somehow it goes perfectly with the curry soup, which is spicy enough to make a Navy SEAL cry. Jay Mao is standing nearby, arms folded. She's smiling, seeing two happy customers. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Pranburi, Thailand.
Hot soup, the perfect comfort food this time of year, especially when it's that spicy, or maybe not when it's that spicy. Thailand's just our starting point. Over the next few weeks, we'll find out what's simmering on stovetops in Haiti, Denmark, and Spain. Warm up with some soup stories from across the globe throughout the holiday season. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Visit us online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. We'll catch you right back here again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge...